Alertly will play it ahead, and Montreal is going to put Caulfield to the bench. Big line trading and heading off. Here's Mangiapane coming down the middle. He scores! Andrew Mangiapane scores from the high slot, coming into the zone. He just beat Jakub Dobesh with 3:37 to go in the third. It's 3-2 Washington.
And that stood as the game winner, John Walton, on the call on our sister station, home of the Caps, 106.7 The Fan. 3:37 left in the third period the other night. A game in which they entered the third trailing 2-1 with Montreal threatening to even up this series. But after that, a couple of empty netters, and the Caps are back home tomorrow night with a chance to put the Canadiens away in five with a 3-1 series lead. Joining us right now is my friend Ben Raby. Ben covers hockey for the Hockey News, for SiriusXM, was many, many years part of the Caps radio broadcast as well. I love talking hockey with Ben because he knows a lot more about hockey than I do. So I want to start with the hit by Tom Wilson the other night, because their goalie, Jakub Dobesh, essentially said, I guess, quote, the rules don't apply for everyone in this league, close quote, implying that that should have been penalized. That led to the game tying goal earlier in the third period when the Caps were down 2-1. So, should it have been penalized or not?
I like the hit. I like that type of game, Kevin, and you're right. It led directly to the game tying goal. It changed the momentum of the entire game and the remainder of the third period. The hit itself, I was okay with. I will say, objectively speaking, Kevin, there was a lot that was called in the game earlier on the night. Again, this was in the third period. There were some ticky-tack calls made earlier, okay, against both teams. So you could make the case, if you are whistling the infractions that were called in periods one and two, you could make an argument that this could have been called as well. I can see that. That being said, I personally feel, and again, this is on both sides, Kevin, Montreal and Washington, there were a lot of things that were called early on the night that really you can raise your hands and say, what were those called for?
So a lot of the interference calls, right?
Yeah, interference, a slash on John Carlson. I mean, there were multiple examples, again, on both sides. And it started very early on. The opening couple of minutes of the game, there's a penalty on Caps defenseman Alexander Alexeyev. And again, I keep saying, I point to, this is on both sides. Capitals had a 5-on-3 power play opportunity in the second period. Montreal had a very valid case. It should have still been 5-on-5. There were ticky-tack calls on both sides. But if that's the way the game was being called, you could then make the argument that Tom Wilson crossed the line in the third period. I don't personally feel that way. I side on the fact that very few of these should have been called anyways. And the hit that Tom Wilson delivered, I was okay with. That's a thunderous hit.
What would have made the hit illegal? Because it was debatable as to whether or not there was contact with the head, I thought. But although the player himself looked a bit wobbly heading off the ice and did not come back into the game.
You can make the case for a charge. You can make the case for a charge. I would not necessarily do that, but that's the infraction that would be called. It would have been a two-minute minor. But again, it's certainly the nature of the hit and the fact that seconds later, down at the other end of the ice, again, this is in the neutral zone, but down in the offensive zone, Brendan Newham scores the goal. Certainly it garnered plenty of attention given what happened seconds after. Had play just continued, had it been whistled seconds later and offside, etc., who knows if it would be such a big conversation. But obviously the result seconds later lends itself to opening the debate.
Is that a play? I'm ignorant to this, so if this is obviously being looked at right now, I apologize for not knowing it, although I tried to find it before the show started. But is this a play that the league reviews after the fact and can fine him?
Could. I don't think there's necessarily that taking place. The league always likes to say, Kevin, they review everything. Everything gets looked at after the fact, so I'm sure it was, whether it was advertised or not. That's sort of a company line by the NHL. They look at everything, and certainly number 43 has a reputation, has a track record. I'm sure it was looked at. I'm sure Montreal, the Canadiens, would have knocked on the door of the league office as well, you know, encouraging them, hey, well, take a look at that play. But haven't heard anything regarding any supplemental discipline or a fine, you know, which isn't to say a fine isn't coming, but haven't necessarily heard anything. And then there won't be a suspension. I mean, it's not a suspendable play. That's not what it was.
At Ben Raby 31 on X on Twitter. So if someone had missed all four of the games played so far, how would you summarize the series other than saying the Caps are up 3-1?
I would summarize it in part by saying the Canadians have hung around thanks in part to the better special teams play. The Canadians have 5 power play goals compared to the Capitals with just 1. Conversely, at 5-on-5, even strength, especially the other night in Game 4, the Capitals have been the much superior team at even strength, where, again, obviously the majority of the game is spent. But you could credit the Montreal Canadiens. They've been able to hang around. They've scored some timely goals. Their Game 3 win on Friday night, when there was so much energy at the Bell Center in Montreal, they took advantage of their special teams opportunities, and the Capitals less so. And I, again, point to the fact that on Sunday night in Game 4, Capitals had this golden opportunity in the second period, trailing 2-1. Yeah. They had north of a minute of a 2-man advantage, and they could not convert. And I will say, credit to the Capitals, that despite that, they were able to regroup and come out in the third period and eventually rally and take the lead, and they went on to win the game. But part of the storyline in this series so far has been the Capitals' much, much stronger play at 5-on-5, Capitals hanging around on special teams. And I say that to say this, Kevin, the Capitals with only 1 power play goal through 4 games. That's due to change at some point. You know, whether that's Game 5, whether that's moving forward later in the playoffs, it's a power play unit which, you know, should be clicking at better than 10%. They're 1 for 10 so far on the man advantage, the Capitals.
Yeah. So why are they 1 for 10?
Just having a tough time finding the back of the net. They've had sustained pressure. They've had zone time, et cetera. I can't tell you exactly why it's not going in, but there are indications. You know, it's not as if they're running around the whole power play. They've had sustained zone time. They've been in control. They have the personnel. And should mention as well, this doesn't impact the power play, but should mention they could potentially be getting a boost as well, even more so at 5-on-5, which I'm referring to, with the potential addition or return, I should say, of Alexei Protas, 30-goal scorer in the regular season. You know, his return, it's been inching closer. From all indications, seems he could be back for Game 5 as well. So that's another encouraging sign there.
Has Montreal missed their starting goaltender, who I thought was outstanding, you know, for the first 2.5 games, Montembeau?
Yeah. No, Jakub Dobish is a good goaltender as well. You know, came on late in the regular season, and I thought did a great job when he came on in relief in Game 3, at least giving the Canadians the opportunity to rally for that win. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's that much of a drop-off. I will say the other angle from a Cap side of things is you did have the return in Game 4, perhaps surprisingly, of Logan Thompson. We didn't necessarily know that. Didn't look good the way he left Game 3. And I'll say from a big-picture standpoint here, Kevin, you have to go back years ago, the last time the Capitals really had an advantage in series in the goaltending head-to-head. You really have to go back to the Braden Holtby years. You've got to go back to either 2019 against Carolina or 2020, the bubble series against the New York Islanders. Since then, it's been a little bit of a revolving door in these parts with starting goaltenders, Samsonov and Vitek Vanacek, et cetera, names from the past. They have not had a goaltending edge in a postseason series in quite some time. And even if Montembeau was healthy and still in this series, the way Logan Thompson has showed himself has been outstanding. He's been terrific. Keep in mind, missed the end of the regular season with a concussion, came back for Game 1. He has been outstanding, and certainly his return in Game 4 shouldn't be overlooked either.
He really has been. I was going to ask you real quickly about the Caulfield. And by the way, he's been an impressive player in this series for Montreal. Whether or not that particular power play goal that gave Montreal a 2-1 lead in the second period, if that was one of those bad goals allowed.
You can make the case. It's a pretty lethal shot Caulfield has as well. And that was a power play goal. And again, both Montreal goals on Sunday night in Game 4 were on the man advantage. But should mention as well, one of the storylines and one of the angles for Montreal's side of things is they have a terrific number one line. They've been very good at even strength, that trio of Caulfield, Nick Suzuki, and Yaroslav Slavkovsky. And tomorrow night, with the Capitals coming back home, the advantage of the last change, they had their hands full in Montreal with that trio. Now, the Canadians, you know, when you're the home team, you have the advantage of putting your players out second.
Right.
You see what the visiting team puts out. They were matching that line, the Canadians were, as much as possible, against Ovechkin in the number one line. The series shifts back to D.C. It will allow the Capitals and Spencer Carberry, anytime the number one line for the Canadians goes out, he's going to put Nick Dowd and Radish and Duhaime, the fourth line for the Capitals, the quote-unquote shutdown line. He'll have that advantage because that trio really gives the Capitals a handful. And not to downplay the offensive weapons and capabilities the Canadians have, but it really starts with those three. They're so good. They have been great in this series. And at least from a Caps perspective, you'll have the opportunity to at least put yourself in better position to contain them with the advantage of the last change here in Game 5.
Look, we've all been around here long enough to know it's never over until it's over with the Caps in the postseason. But 3-1 coming back home, they'll have two home games of the final three if they need them. Hopefully they won't. Let's just assume for a moment that they do advance. What's the matchup look like against Carolina in the second round? Because it looks like Carolina, with a 3-1 series lead against New Jersey, will advance as well.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. It's a real intriguing one. Carolina gave the Capitals a tough time. They played twice late in the season, just in April, just in the past couple of weeks. Carolina had a blowout win in their place in Raleigh, and then they met the following week here in D.C. The Capitals had to rally in the third period to force overtime, eventually won the game in a shootout. It's a pesky Carolina team that certainly wouldn't be intimidated by any means of the Capitals. They've matched up very well against them. And it's a team, again, we're looking ahead now of this potential series, but it's a team in Carolina. Their mantra is they shoot everything. They lead the league in shots on goal. They'll shoot from anywhere. That's what they do. They're a high-volume shot team. Capitals know this, of course, but it could be a busy series for Logan Thompson. We'll put it that way. They're a very aggressive team once they gain the blue line, Carolina.
Overall, Ben, in this postseason, I mean, the West has had, you know, I think every series is 2-2, although I guess after last night, Dallas is up 3-2. Yep. Who's been super impressive so far here in the first round?
I have to think about that for a minute. I'm impressed that the St. Louis Blues have earned back-to-back blowout wins over top-seeded Winnipeg out west.
Right.
In both games, Connor Hellebuyck, arguably the best goalie in the league, had to be pulled. I think St. Louis and what they've been able to do to get themselves back in the series is impressive. And even if Winnipeg, again, the top seed out west, even if they move on to face the winner of Colorado, Dallas, I do wonder if a piece of them has taken a hit here as far as what the Blues have been able to do to them. So the Blues' ability to claw their way back in the series has impressed. And I'll say on the eastern side of things, you know, there's always drama, okay, surrounding the Toronto Maple Leafs. You know, to make a comparison, they're sort of the Dallas Cowboys, right? They're the team with a long history, but seemingly can't get over the hump in the postseason. They take up a lot of oxygen. And I will say they've had this first-round series against Ottawa, the Battle of Ontario, and it's been relatively quiet and businesslike for Toronto. And as they seek an elusive, deep postseason run, which, again, has eluded them for decades, I do wonder if for that core, that's maybe a good thing. They could win that series as soon as tonight, Game 5 back in Toronto. Looking ahead, if they are, again, to have that elusive deep postseason run, this relatively quiet, business-like first-round series maybe will do them some good.
All right, last one, because I know you're very familiar with the Bell Center and with Montreal and their fan base. I mean, just watching it on TV the other night, and I actually flipped back and forth to get the TBS and the Monumental, because Monumental actually, I think, pipes in the crowd noise a little bit better than TBS did. But I wanted that was just watching on TV Friday night and for moments during the game on Sunday night. Is that the best home environment in hockey?
I think so. I mean, I'm biased maybe, or recency biased. You know, obviously we saw what they showed over the weekend and going back to last Friday, but it's really special. And one of the things, and again, having grown up there, there's bias there too. But Kevin, the thing about going to a game in Montreal is that, you know, and this is growing now even with more females playing hockey on the regular, but every male in the building, okay, has played the game at some level, you know, right. Whether it's and everything, people there know the game and they know when to get involved and when to get excited for subtle plays, for little things. And then you combine that with the energy before the game, the presentation before the game, you know, the all the pregame pomp and circumstance that surrounds it in Montreal. There's a lot of things that go into making it a very special atmosphere. And especially at this time of year, which it's been a while in Montreal, they reached the cup final in the COVID year when attendance was very limited, right, especially in Canada. They've waited 8 years, right, to have a sold-out building for a playoff game. There's a lot of pent-up energy, I think, leading up to Friday night especially. And you combine that again with the passion, with the knowledge of the fan base. It's a lot of things that go into making it a very, very special building, special place to watch a game.
I had a friend of mine reach out to me over the weekend and say, Montreal for a playoff game should be on your bucket list. It's as good as anything that he's been to, and he's been to a bunch of sporting events in a lot of different places, but he said it was insane on Friday night. Thanks for doing this. Hope you're well.
Yeah, likewise, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Ben Raby, everybody, at BenRaby31 on X and on Twitter. Next, Chris Cooley's film breakdown of Josh Connerly Jr. Right after these words from a few of our sponsors. Don't forget, you can stream us now live on our Team 980 YouTube page. So there is some news related to the football team. Washington, according to Tom Pelissero at the NFL Network, has signed veteran kicker Matt Gay to a one-year, $4.25 million fully guaranteed contract. According to Pelissero, it is the most fully guaranteed money for a kicker on a one-year deal in NFL history. He can earn up to $5 million with reachable incentives. So what are they getting in Matt Gay? Matt Gay's kicked for 6 years in the NFL. Was drafted by Tampa, kicked with the Rams for 3 years in 2020, 2021, and 2022. The last 2 years in Indianapolis. So the last 5 years, the majority of his games have been indoors. He has been very good on PATs after his rookie year. He's missed just four total extra points in five seasons over his career. He's got a big leg. He's connected on 58 yarders twice in his career. By the way, he holds the NFL record for the most 50-plus yard field goals in a game. He kicked four on September 24th, 2023 at home against the Ravens. His 58-yarder as a rookie is the longest field goal by a rookie kicker in NFL history. He also had a run of the most successful field goal attempts by a rookie kicker. He made 27 in a row. That's tied for the best all-time with Martin Gramatica. But again, that was as a rookie. And in recent years in Indianapolis, he has struggled a little bit more on field goal percentage. He had his career, after his rookie season, his career low in 2023 at 80.5%. Now, he was 33 of 41. Five of the eight misses came from 50-plus. And then last year, all six of his missed field goals, he was 83.8%. He was 31 of 37, came from 50-plus. He was 3 for 9 on 50-yard plus field goals. Inside 50 last year, he was perfect. He was 28 for 28 on kicks inside 40 last year for Indy. The year before on kicks inside 40, he missed two. He was 26 of 28 that year. Matt Gay signed, and by the way, Zane Gonzalez released. If you didn't know, he was re-signed to a very minimal deal to be a part of the roster, you know, the training camp roster. We always thought there was a chance they would be looking for another kicker. They found him. Matt Gay signing a fully guaranteed 4.5 point, or is it 4.25? What did Pelissero say? 4.25 million fully guaranteed means he's going to be the kicker in 2025, unless he absolutely soils himself in preseason training camp or maybe even early in the season. Matt Gay is your new Washington kicker. All right, Cooley joined me on Friday after the draft. Joined me Friday afternoon. I put him to work. He spent some time looking at Josh Connerly Jr., watched a lot of tape. I'm not even sure when I reached him that he even knew the draft had happened. But I said, will you, you know, get on your computer and watch, you know, 30 to 60 minutes of some Josh Connerly and tell us what you think. So that's what he did, and here was his film breakdown of Washington's first-round pick.
I really like Josh Connerly. I think he's big time. I think it's really interesting what they do with him, and I'm sure that they have a plan. Because I understand you take whatever you think is best available, but you don't take a left tackle if you just acquired a left tackle. So I'm assuming he's the right tackle for him.
Right.
Look, the kid is huge. I mean, he's 6'5", 310. He's unbelievably athletic, and it shows when you watch him on film, but he runs a 5.0 40 pretty much, 34.5-inch vert. That's big vert for an offensive lineman. 34.5?
Yeah.
For a 310-pound man?
Athletic.
That's huge. So he's an athlete, and you would assume somebody that's an athlete like that should be able to flip sides. It really isn't. I just can't. I understand it's a big deal, but as somebody that flips sides every other play, I don't quite understand why it's such a big deal. If you're an athlete, go play on the other side. It shouldn't be that tough. So he is. He's an incredible athlete. The first thing that jumps off the page to me with him is his footwork. And when I watch him in the run game, especially when they run at him, like their front side zone towards him, they run that zone play towards him, and he's got to stretch and overtake a defensive end who's wider. He does a really good job with it. He can push out with width, continue to get good inside arm punch, and extend the hole so the back has a cut lane. You're not, when you're doing that as a tackle outside, the back's almost never going to get outside of you. So your job is to stretch the defensive end as wide as possible so there's a cutback inside of that or all the way back. And I think when you watch Connerly, he does a phenomenal job of this. And the biggest start is his feet. He is athletic. He's very quick. He can move incredibly well, but his feet get him going. He doesn't take false steps. He doesn't take missteps. He's technically sound in his footwork. And I was really impressed with that. It's the exact same for him on the backside of run plays when he's got to cut off a defensive tackle inside of him. I think he does an exceptional job going the other way, away from him, which is to his right. So if you're evaluating, can the guy step and move to his right? Yeah. So he could block open zone on the right side, in theory, right? Good footwork to the right, good footwork to the left. Should be able to block on the right side or the left side. Just consider the new backside, the front side. I think he does a really good job on angles with run plays away. He understands the angle of attack where you have to get to a guy. And some guys really struggle with that. You take too sharp of an angle and then you're trying to square up to get in front of somebody and all of a sudden they're across your face and in front of you on the other side. I think he has a good understanding of angles probably a stud in geometry, man.
Not my best subject, by the way. I was a good math student. Not geometry wasn't my thing. I bet it was your thing. I bet you were good at geometry.
I don't remember. Like 13, we had geometry.
Yeah.
It's been a while.
All right. What else? Right. He's good with angles.
Game. He likes a quick set, like a jump set, against a lot of speed pass rushers. You envision an offensive lineman in a drop back doing that big kick backward step. That's hilarious if somebody that doesn't know football tries to do in a bar.
Right.
But that big one kick your outside foot back far, slide your inside foot. And we'll get to that, but he likes to get hands on guys quick. And I'm impressed with this quite a bit because he has the ability to then run with speed rushers. So he'll get hands on, and a lot of times when you get hands on like that, they get to the edge a little bit. You've created a short pocket, and if they're able to get around the backside edge, then you're in trouble. But he's able to open up and run with those guys. He has good mirror skills. He can mirror a pass rusher up to 7, 8, 9 yards and create that deeper pocket, giving the quarterback an opportunity to step up in the pocket. That, to me, I think that with some of the frontside run game stuff and his ability to quick set is pretty awesome. That's a first-round guy that can do that stuff. The athleticism to be able to accomplish those things are a third of the tackles in the league, half the tackles at best in the league, can functionally quick set and run with guys and open side stretch his zone. He does them both well. When he is in a deep set situation, I think it's really sound. A lot of tackles will deep set and they'll start to kick and they'll open their outside hip up. And you don't want to do that. You want to stay square to the line of scrimmage. He does a good job of keeping his body square to the line of scrimmage until he makes contact. And then it'll open up a little bit. But he's really square and he creates a problem for those rushers. They can't come underneath well. And it's a wide angle for them to get around the corner. So he sets himself up well with that. He has good patience with his hands in pass game. A lot of times offensive linemen want to lean their hands out or reach their hands out for guys, which makes their body lean over, and then they're susceptible to anything a pass rusher wants to do. He has good posture. He waits. He times his punch up well and does a good job with his hand punch. I think he's really effective with that. He sees twists and edges, blitzes really well. And again, going back to the last thing I just said, where he's able to stay square, he's able to keep good vision with things like that. He's not turned, so he can go back the other way. So when you get twist rushers or blitzers off the edge or inside, he's able to pick those things up. So one, good square set. Two, good vision, good understanding of where he's got to go, and ability to get there with speed. All those things are massive positives. I mean, you watch the kid and you watch him against Abdul Carter, who went, third from Penn State. Yeah. You watch him against Ohio State. And against big-time players, he's a big-time player. He doesn't struggle when he gets to a different level of pass rusher, which makes him a first-round pick. You know, you look at a lot of guys and say, hey, they're great when they play Oregon State and good when they play UCLA, which, by the way, the conference thing messes me up anyway.
Yeah, but right. They're in the Big Ten. They were in the
great,
Big Ten.
He's great against Maryland, and he was a stud against Rutgers.
Right.
He's big time against Penn State. He was huge against Ohio State, and he's still functionally doing the same things. He's in no way overwhelmed by talent. I mean, again, that makes him a first-round pick. So the positives are incredibly positive. I think on the upside, on the ceiling side with this kid, his athleticism, his current fundamental basis of where he's at is not this guy's good, but we got to teach him a lot. I don't think technically he's pretty sound. Athletically, he's completely there. He's got all the physical skill set. On the negative side, which there's not a ton, man, his block sustain is not phenomenal. He's got a good punch when he gets into guys, but his ability to sustain and keep on blocks is not there yet. And sometimes that's just an attitude deal. Kev, sometimes it's, I'm just going to finish this dude off. He gets the block to where it needs to be, and then he says, okay, I did it. I have no idea what he actually says, but his ability to sustain blocks for an extended period of time is not 100% there. He's got good hands, but once he loses contact, he doesn't always stay with contact. He's got such a big body that it's hard sometimes for them to get around him or get in front of him. This isn't a massive glaring issue. It's a check mark on film, job done. I think some guys just have this nasty streak. Trent Williams would be a good example. It's just nasty streak where the job's done when I finish you on the ground. That's not necessarily our guy here. The only real concern I have is him getting pushed around a little bit. Sometimes he's high, and when a defensive end or D-tackle gets hands inside of him, they can push the pocket, and they can push him back more than you think. And, you know, I thought of it like this. You could think maybe he's weak. He's not a strong enough dude. He didn't do the bench press at the combine. The only reason you don't do that as a lineman is you can't get 20. But I don't know if it's necessarily that. And I'm going to give you my comp to what I feel like this is at times. You ever, you're playing defense in a basketball game, and you got someone squared up, and they start to back you down to the hoop.
Yeah.
And you feel like you're playing good defense, and they turn around and shoot, and all of a sudden you realize the hoop's right there.
Yeah.
How did he get? Like, I don't feel like we went 8 feet towards the hoop here.
Like you did to me that one time in your backyard. Yes. Yeah.
It's somewhat like that.
You're trying to hold your ground without fouling. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's. I feel like that's the exact same thing. It's. I don't know if he's really weak. He's massive. But he gets moved backwards more than you'd like. And sometimes this is in the run game as well. He's not overly physical in any way. And he's always got his feet are always moving. And sometimes you just like him to set hard and anchor his back foot and just stop pressure. And so I don't know. He gets on his heels a little bit as his feet start to move. And he's kind of chopping his feet. He doesn't finish fully with his hands. And that is a concern and that is a weakness that he has in a five-step drop back or a longer developing pass play that he's getting pushed into the lap of the quarterback. It's something that he will need to work on is his ability to sustain a direct bull rush in the pass game and keep his chest down in the run game and keep his hat down so he's moving forward instead of getting pushed backwards into gaps. Last couple things. I think this goes hand in hand with this. I think he could just use his hips better when he punches. A lot of times he's got a little bit of forward lean, like think about his ass kind of bent outwards, and he's punching his hands. Man, if he'd bring his ass and hips forward as he punches, I think he'd be a lot more effective with his punch. I don't love his ability to get up to linebackers and second-level players, and I think this is also something that can be taught and learned, and this is also maybe something that is taught at Oregon. He's always in that weird, like, shuffle step. It's like a duck walk almost. Like, you walk your feet and you chop your feet.
I saw what you did there, the duck walk at Oregon.
Yeah, you kind of just – yeah, that is funny. Yeah, sometimes when you come off a first-level block in double-team situations, you got to go up to backers in the second level. You just open up and run. I mean, it's not a full dead sprint, but you got to open up your stride a little bit and attack that angle. So I said he's really good on angles on the front level, right at the line of scrimmage. I don't think he's phenomenal getting up to backers. Again, this could be the way they're coaching him in the run game. Last thing, at times he'll get confident on his quick sets and he'll overset. It's not his deep sets. It's that quick jump on him. Jump quick, get your hands on him. He has a tendency at times to jump a little bit wider. And in those situations, that's where he gets that up and then under rush. And he can give up some up and under rush and get beat in those situations. So, that again, that's an easily fixable, coachable thing. It's just the track of where you're jump setting. I think the positives glaringly outweigh any negatives. I think all these negatives are incredibly minimal. You work on whatever it takes to not get pushed back the way he does. And the rest of them are easily teachable things. And to me, he's an outstanding athlete with an unbelievable upside. It's an athletic tackle that they're getting. And, you know, in the Tunsil situation, you think about it, he can move back to left tackle if anything happens with Tunsil. He can move back to left tackle in 2 or 3 years. I think the kid can play everywhere. I don't think he's a guard.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that.
I don't necessarily see him as an interior player. And in part, I think his skill set on the edge is too valuable. Tend up using him on the inside.
Got it.
Combine that with the fact that he's able to get bold a little bit. I like my inside guys to be a little bit stouter. I think he remains outside. I would expect that he would play right tackle. Who knows? You never know what happens when they get into practice and what need ends up being. But I think the goal would probably be to have him outside.
All right. A couple of quick questions for you, and then I'll let you run. I appreciate this, as you know. So Cliff Kingsbury put a note on Adam Peters' desk, apparently saying, "Oregon tackle, please." Meaning he really wanted Josh Connerly to be the pick. You know, Kingsbury has a lot of quick game, a lot of screens, traditional screens, bubble screens, etc. I'm assuming that Kingsbury really liked Connerly Jr. because of the athleticism and because this guy's going to be phenomenal in space and in their pass game, their line of scrimmage pass game in particular.
Yeah, he can run. He can absolutely run. And I don't see any real concern with – I see a lot of positives in that. But again, he's going to have to open up and run. Screens are a little bit different than second-level blocks, though. You have to run. Yeah, I think he could be big time in the screen game.
All right, one last thing that I want to ask you or just get clarity on. This team struggled to run the football, especially with running backs down the stretch. And I want to find out from you, based on something you said – what you really believe about Connerly Jr. as a run blocker, because you suggested that maybe he's not, you know, super strong, that he, you know, struggles getting to second levels, to double teams. Is that from you sort of a way of saying or implying that you don't think that his strength anyway is as a run blocker?
No, I don't agree with that. Sorry, I'm sorry. I think he's an outstanding run blocker on the first level. And I think in one-on-one situations, he can do a tremendous job in the run game. I actually see him as an incredibly effective run blocker.
Okay.
I think that you could improve by him getting to the second level, but in that aspect, I think some of that's a coachable situation for him. No, I think it's a big time. I love the pick. I mean, you get Jaden Daniels, and you see exactly what he is through the year, you got to go protect the dude. You got to give him an opportunity to stay safe.
Yeah.
I mean, they went out and did it. And look, whatever other need you have, this is the one thing that you have. The quarterback is the one thing that you have to have. And you have to protect, and you have to have continue to play for an extended period of time. The franchise guy has got to be your guy. And as a young player, protect him.
All right, well done. I know you got to run. Much appreciated. That was incredibly helpful and great. I'll talk to you later.
Have a good one, bud.
That was Chris Cooley from the other day breaking down Josh Connerly Jr. I'll try to get him to do Amos and a few of the other guys as well over the next few weeks. Ben Standig will join us at 12. When we come back, Washington's over-under number on wins for 2025 dropped after the draft. I'll tell you what it dropped to when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
All right, the Washington Commanders are releasing Zane Gonzalez and signing kicker Matt Gay from the Indianapolis Colts. Gay will receive $4.25 fully guaranteed on a one-year deal. The 49ers have locked up George Kittle with a four-year $76 million extension that includes $40 million guaranteed. He becomes the highest-paid tight end in the National Football League. Not a fun day to be a Nats fan yesterday as they got smoked by the New York Mets 19-5. Brandon Nimmo with four of six with two home runs, including a grand slam, nine total RBIs. Trevor Williams pitched 5.1 innings, earning 5 Ks and giving up 5 earned runs. The Nats will take on the Phillies at 6:45 on 106.7 The Fan. The Caps look to close out their series versus Montreal tomorrow from Capital One Arena. Alex Ovechkin was not on the ice at practice this morning. No worries there. The team has called it a maintenance day. Alexei Protas, though, looks to be a full go at practice this morning. He will likely join the lineup tomorrow. Spencer Carberry declined to give any specifics. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980 and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
So depending on which sports book you frequent, if you do, the over-under numbers for the NFL season in terms of win totals, most shops put something out before the draft. Washington, in a number of places, was at 10.5. 10.5 would mark the highest over-under win total heading into a season for Washington since 2000. You know, the year in which they, in free agency, signed Deion Sanders, Bruce Smith, Mark Carrier, you know, Jeff George, etc. So the expectations win total-wise were the highest. Now, after the draft, I've seen that drop in multiple spots, including places like BetMGM, to 9.5. So it would seem that the odds makers weren't like blown away by their draft. I have a hard time believing that a team that picks at 29 with 5 overall picks, that wasn't factored into the number before the draft. You know, this wasn't a team that had number 6 and ended up picking a player that nobody thought they should pick. I mean, no one's really knocking the Josh Connerly Jr. pick. The biggest criticism from people out there analyzing Washington's draft is that they didn't get a need position when that need was loaded with players, that being a pass rusher, a defensive end, or an edge. I think more likely than not, the reason the number dropped from 10.5 to 9.5 in a couple of spots. Now, it was 9.5 in certain spots to begin with, but it has dropped in a number of spots from 10.5 to 9.5. I think it might have to do with the rest of the division. The rest of the division, you know, according to the experts, again, I don't put much stock into draft grades. I just don't think they hold up very well 3 years down the road. But people love Dallas's draft. I think a lot of people thought the Giant draft was pretty damn good. The Giants, you know, were able to draft Abdul Carter. They came back into the first round and got maybe their future quarterback. I would question that in Jackson Dart. They drafted Cam Scataboo, the running back from Arizona State, in the 4th round. And then, of course, you know, Howie Roseman gets stroked after every draft. But, you know, this team that was so dominant defensively, their first 5 picks were defensive players, including a player that many believe is penciled in as a week one starter at safety, Andrew Mukaba, from Texas. People loved that pick at the end of the 2nd round. I've seen a lot of people high on Ty Robinson, their 4th round pick in particular. They also, like they seem to do every year, they drafted a quarterback. They drafted the Syracuse quarterback, former Ohio State quarterback, Kyle McCord, in the 6th round. He had a breakout season for him at Syracuse after, you know, finding a rough go of it at Ohio State and Columbus. Their first round pick, they actually swapped positions with Kansas City, moved up and took Jahad Campbell, a very highly thought of linebacker out of Alabama, but with some injury issues and even some question as to whether or not he'll be ready to play in 2025's early portion of the schedule. But remember, Philly lost some stuff defensively too. You know, they lost Darius Slay, they lost CJ Gardner-Johnson, and I'm forgetting somebody else defensively. But they loaded up on defensive players, even though there was a defense in Philadelphia last year that was as good as any we've seen in recent years. And by the way, it carried them to a Super Bowl win over Kansas City. But they will be loaded on defense again. We'll see what happens with some of their young players. But that would be my guess, is that there was just more positive talk about Philly, because the other thing that happened simultaneously is the division odds. Philadelphia increased their division odds, their NFC East division odds. They went from like minus, you know, 175, 180 to minus 145, 150. Washington had actually made it into like the plus 180 mark. Now they're at like plus 200 to plus 225, depending on where you're looking. What does it mean? Not much. Just gives you an indication of what the odds makers kind of think of the teams right now. And the most, you know, recent update comes after the draft. All right, Ben Standing usually joins us on Monday, and he did join us yesterday. It just so happens he joined us at the end of the press conference, and we had about 2 minutes with Ben. So he'll jump on with me next. Kevin Sheehan Show, The Team 980, and theteam980.com.